Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, licensed marriage family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, emotion worker, and social critic. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. We invite your calls and story to 781-3875. Good afternoon, Elizabeth.
Hello, Brian. I'm madly moving things around in the studio.
Me too. I'm out of breath from running.
How are you this week?
I'm doing great.
I heard there's a milestone in your house.
Yeah, today is our baby's 3-month birthday. He's 3 months old today.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
And so what have you noticed as the biggest changes?
He's recognizing things. He could focus his eyes and he smiles when he recognizes people's faces. So he's smiling and laughing and looking around and taking it all in.
That's so great.
It's pretty exciting, yeah.
And you look a little more rested than you have in the past.
That's good.
Not feeling it.
No.
That's all right. Well, I'm excited to be back. I missed you last week. I think you know that I was traveling to Tennessee with my daughter and her teammate for a competition, Destination Imagination, the world's largest creative thinking competition. They were state champions along with 6 other teams from our area, and they got to travel to Knoxville, Tennessee to compete against 1,200 other teams from around the world.
Wow.
It's quite something. It's a week-long event, and it's the 6th time that I've been able to go with the kids to compete. They did great. They came in 4th place in the world. I thought it was fabulous. But for them, victory had to be in the top 3 spots. They needed to be in the top 3. So 4th place was just devastating. Just devastating. But it was a really interesting trip because it was the first time that I've actually done that kind of travel without my husband along as kind of my backup, my wingman.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really kind of anxious about doing this trip from the beginning. And I learned a lot about myself through this experience. So I'm excited to kind of talk about some of the things that came up today.
Mm-hmm.
But before we jump to that, I just want to welcome everyone to a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I am Elizabeth Barrett. And you can find us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, if you'd like to get information about shows that are upcoming. You can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org and look at the program archives tab. We have all of our previous shows there. And you can always send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. I love to hear from you. Because we get together once a week to kind of talk about those things that go on in our lives and how either we're helping ourselves through our behaviors or maybe getting in the way of our own mental health and well-being through some of our behaviors. I'm going to share our stories. And I love that you always say at the beginning, call in and share your story.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's in talking about those things that we experience in our day-to-day life that help us to feel normal, whatever that is, or feel like there's other people that can appreciate some of our struggles. Or saying our story out loud somehow frees us from stories that might be bogging us down. And so that's the idea of our program each week, is to give people a forum to talk about those things that they struggle with. Some of the things that we might be concerned about, or relationship issues that have us feeling frustrated, or parenting issues, or marriage issues, and all those marriage and family therapist realm that I live in, all the relational pieces. I thought, here's a place that we can talk about those things and maybe help each other kind of muddle through. Because what I found, you know, over the almost 20 years that I've been doing this work is that we all suffer from very similar things. The similar things bog us down in our lives. And I thought if we could talk about it openly, that we would not feel so alone in our struggles, whether it's through communication issues or trying to find relationships at work or feeling good about who we are on the planet. And that's kind of what came up for me this week, was this a new way of looking at myself. And at 52, it's fun to see myself in different and new ways. So I don't know. I'm not sure if I want to jump in with the story or let you tell your story, but we're going to talk about neurosis. Do you know what the word means, Brian?
It just makes me think of neurotic, and then I picture somebody pulling their hair out.
Yeah, oh, there you go. I always picture Woody Allen
as
kind of the poster boy for neurotic, or being a neurotic.
Mm-hmm.
Spent his life, you know, making a lot of money writing movies about his perception and perspective of the world from his neurotic sphere. Being a neurotic is the definition: a person afflicted with a neurosis who tends to be emotionally unstable or unusually anxious. I can relate to that feeling quite often in my life. There's times that I feel generally anxious and maybe emotionally unstable, things that throw me off. But it's funny because for a lot of people, the idea of neurosis or being neurotic makes them fearful, because we have this idea of our mental health as being a very tenuous thing. And, you know, we talk a lot about the stigma about mental health in our culture, that people are concerned about talking about feeling anxious or feeling depressed or having phobias or struggling in their lives for fear of being seen as mentally ill and therefore weak or not someone who can balance their life or be a productive citizen. And so that stigma about mental health and struggling with things makes people feel very alone. That we tend to feel that if people knew some of the weird things in our lives, the way that we're a freak, that other people wouldn't accept us, that we'd feel isolated or ostracized. And I know that that's something that kind of drove me into this field, was this curiosity about things that drove me from the time I was a little kid, things that I was kind of fearful of. You know, I was a super hypochondriac when I was young, to the point of my parents, you know, probably had a open standing appointment at the doctor's office at my pediatrician. And so I was there, it seemed like a lot, being told that I was fine. And I kept saying, but I'm not, I'm, you know, nervous. I wake up in the middle of the night. And, you know, I was a very high strung kid. And so these feelings from a very young age of being very high strung, having a lot of kind of free floating anxiety and going through my teenage years and having a lot of angst and feeling pretty alone with all of those feelings and feeling like I was the only one, right, who could possibly be feeling so out of sorts or worrying about my health or, you know, concerned that I wasn't normal, that it really exaggerated because I never really talked to anyone about it. Because my fear was if I told my friends that I felt this way, they would think I was weird, right? And I would be ostracized. So I didn't talk about it. And it just got more kind of crippling as I went through my teens into my early 20s. And I felt I really needed to hide those feelings about myself, any negative feelings I had about myself, and really present as super productive and super functioning and, you know, always having it completely all together, because I assumed that everyone else in the world had it all together. And so that effort to keep myself completely tied in this little box, you can only maintain that for so long. And it was one of the reasons that I thought, I really want to figure out why I feel like jello on the inside, but I'm, you know, trying to present as this totally normal person. And going to school was so freeing because I was able to see that we all feel like jello on the insides at different times in our life. And that was the first step to really being free to accept myself and feel good about myself and going on and doing this work and really wanting to help other people to embrace all those parts of themselves that they might feel as less than or makes them stand out in different ways. So I just thought, you know, I had this really interesting experience with the kids this week traveling to Tennessee. One is that I don't like to travel. I don't like to fly at all. Don't enjoy it. I really try to enjoy it. I really do. And I get in the right space and, you know, just get on there and say, I'm just going to let myself go because it's fun. But I really hate it. I'm uncomfortable the whole time. And my whole family knows it. And, you know, for 2 days before I go on a trip, they try to avoid me. I can see them taking a big wide swing around me. But I don't like it. But I also noticed that on this trip, that without my husband there as kind of my balance, I just had to depend on myself. And I did really well this time. Still wasn't totally loving the flying part. But we got there, rented a car, drove across the state, stayed for 5 days. And I felt pretty strong the whole time. I thought, wow, I just surprised myself. I'm a little more capable at this traveling, you know, taking care of the family, getting places than I ever thought. Mm-hmm. This renewed sense of strength. And then I also noticed that I was able to step back a little bit and really observe my kids, to observe Kelly and Kyle, her teammate, as they were kind of going through their process. Because I was so comfortable and present in myself that I wasn't, you know, usually I'll get so blinded by my own anxiousness that I don't notice what my family's doing. I'm just kind of, anxious. But I was so calm that I got to watch my kids. And I noticed that they each have their own little set of quirky behaviors that I don't know if I fully ever appreciated or noticed before. And it was those quirky behaviors that were the cutest thing on the trip. Their superstitions about how to get ready for the competition and wearing orange or having the right headpiece on or, you know, making sure their stuff was packed the right way. I really loved watching them go through their process. But I also noticed, because they're both really highly functioning, very intelligent kids, that there's a certain level of anxiety that goes along with being very high functioning and very intelligent. And I think that I noticed, not for the first time, because I knew that there were some things that, you know, Kelly is nervous about, but really seeing how they've coped in some ways with the anxiety by developing these behaviors. One of them likes to have sunscreen all the time, always putting sunscreen on, or always having chapstick on, and kind of like this nervous putting chapstick on. I thought, what an interesting coping mechanism that they're using, just kind of to calm themselves in the action of putting the chapstick on. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I knew a comedian when I worked on cruise ships that he would spend 5 minutes just putting chapstick on his lips right before he went on to do his act.
Yeah, and I think there is that in that motion of just kind of brings the tension down, and they found this coping mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, they might think, oh, that's, you know, a nervous tic or something unhealthy or wrong. We need to fix it. But it got me thinking about all the ways that we learn to kind of cope in our lives when anxiety pops up, that we all kind of go through these times that we're nervous. What are some of the things that we do to help calm ourselves? And also this week, I was reading a book that we're going to talk about in the next couple of weeks. I think it's called A Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. Very interesting. But what came up for me from reading that book is it's just a very strict way of parenting your children to perfection. And I thought, you know, I know that throughout the years, I had this fear of kind of passing on these crippling behaviors that I always felt inhabited me. You know, I didn't want my kids to feel anxious flying. I didn't want them to feel nervous about, you know, anything in their life. I wanted them to not feel insecure about themselves. Any of the things that I had struggled with, I worked really hard to overcome them so I could model this strength for my kids and that they would never feel any of those things. And, you know, I wanted them to kind of bypass all of the normal adolescent things that I'd had and somehow jump right into adulthood nearly perfect, because I didn't want them to suffer with any of the things that I had suffered with and still suffer with in some way. But what I realized is that I think in my efforts to make sure they bypassed all of those anxious feelings or things that I struggled with, they developed their own quirks, you know, right, their own little neurotic tendencies and behaviors. And I think that I kind of failed to recognize in some ways their own unique wiring, that I wanted to parent to perfection, and somehow that somehow if I did everything right that they wouldn't have any of these struggles. And I think I might have missed out, my own, you know, anxiety about this made me miss out in reading each of my girls' own unique way of taking in the world and how they process things in their body. And so it made me want to talk about neuroses and how we as a community deal with those things that we sometimes struggle with in our lives when we feel generalized anxiety. Or do you suffer with hypochondria? Do you worry about your, you know, your health? Or do you have little rituals that you do, kind of OCD-like behaviors? We're going to talk about it today. So if you'd like to join the conversation, talk about some of those things that you struggle with or maybe that you feel embarrassed about, you wouldn't want anyone to know that you have to eat green leafy vegetables all day long out of a baggie, or that you brush your hair incessantly, or you have, you know, things that you do on a regular basis that you wouldn't want anyone to know. We're going to talk about it, and you can call in at 781-3875. It's a conversation with a reluctant therapist, and I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and we'll be back to take your calls.
That number again is 781-3875. It's area code 805-781-3875. Coming up at 3 o'clock today, it's Fresh Air with Terry Gross, the Peabody Award-winning weekday magazine of contemporary arts and issues. Then at 4 o'clock, American Public Media's Marketplace presents news on business, economics, and money for the rest of us. And at 4:30, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. That number again to talk to Elizabeth Barrett, the reluctant therapist, is 781-3875.
You know, you can also find us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or through email, elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. So today I'm kind of rambling all over because I have this lofty topic in my head about talking about neuroses. And it's also a generalized list of other things that we struggle with. Maybe our blind spots. Maybe it's our neurotic tendencies, personality quirks, phobias, you know, things that we try to hide from the general population for fear that they'll know that there's something weird about us and not want to spend time with us. But I want to talk about the definition of a neurosis, because I think, again, when we look at the spectrum of mental health, there is the psychosis, which prevents us from being able to function in society in any sort of productive way. And then on the other end would be the mild neurosis, those things that we all kind of struggle with in different ways. But I think we tend to lump all mental health issues into one big barrel. And that's what gives it a stigma. And it makes people go into hiding with their behaviors. And when we go into hiding with our behaviors, whether, you know, it's the way we're eating or the way we exercise or sleep habits, things that might start to feel off for us, when we start to hide those behaviors, they start to get bigger. They start to take on a life of their own in our lives and start to feel more overwhelming or more strange or more out of the ordinary. And then we really feel like there's something wrong with us. But neurosis, by definition, is a relatively mild mental illness that is not caused by an organic disease and involves symptoms of stress, anxiety, depression, and it can be an excessive and irrational anxiety or obsession that we feel. A neurosis, again, is mild. And we talk about mental illness, maybe if we compare illness to physical illnesses where you have a cold and the flu, right? So something that knocks you out for a few days with sneezes and sniffles, or you have the flu that wipes you out and you feel like you're just never going to be better. So neurosis would be down in the cold realm of mental illness, and that we all go through them at certain times in our lives. Maybe after a difficult breakup, we can feel very depressed or anxious. And then going through the process of dealing with the breakup, we can start to develop kind of different habits or behaviors to calm ourselves. You know, the important thing about the neurosis is that it affects only part of the personality, and it's something that we're able to still work in reality of our daily lives. It's not a psychosis where we're unable to connect with, you know, reality on a regular basis, but that feeling of anxiety and depression that we can have with a neurotic response can come with physical symptoms. You can get stomach aches or headaches or back aches or body aches, or your heart can race or your hands will, you know, feel sweaty. An anxiety attack is part of a neurotic response. We can have other symptoms like impaired concentration. It's hard to focus. Some definite tics like jerking can be part of neurotic responses, and some sexual dysfunctions are related to neurotic responses. And so they'd all be kind of considered on this realm of normal human experiences, normalized responses to stress in our lives. They also can be unlearned over a process of time, but for some people, they become part of who they are, that wiring of being either highly strung or having little ritual behaviors, superstitious behaviors, become part of who we are on a regular basis. So, William, what do you think about this topic? You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Well, it's fascinating. It sounds like you're speaking to me on so many levels, but I don't know really quite where to start, dear. I'm 62 years old. I have three wonderful sons, but I've had a difficulty with one son for decades now, and it seems to be getting sometimes better and sometimes worse, but it's so many of the symptoms that you've described about anxiety and just finding ways of coping with it, and he's been diagnosed, but I don't know exactly what the diagnosis is. He's on some medications, and the medications seem to help, but it's just heartbreaking, frankly, as a father to watch your son kind of devolve into this mental illness. And it's all, it just seems to be so many things make him anxious, and he can't drive a car anymore, or if he's around people in a large room too much, he has to leave, and things like that. And quite frankly, in the earlier times of my relationship with him, he was really a difficult child because he was really so frustrated. And so it was a lot of drama and a lot of family get-togethers kind of broken up. And so we became distanced, and I know that's not what I want to do, but it's difficult to know what to do.
Mm-hmm. I think, William, I love that you've called to share your story. I appreciate you taking the time, because I think as parents, there's a lot of fear that we are going to make things worse. And that, right? And that, yes, we start to feel anxious when our children are struggling because we want things to be perfect. We want them to be comfortable, and we don't know how to fix it. And then our own anxiety gets the best of us, and we tend to somehow start bouncing that off of our children. And I've just noticed from my own experience, my parents are both pretty highly strung people. And my dad and I can really, if we get in the same room and we're both feeling pretty anxious, I can feel it emanating off of him, and I can barely sit in my own body. And it's just, I don't know if you can relate to that at all.
I can.
So as parents, sometimes even in our best intentions, we can trigger things in our children because they are very attuned to us. And so I think that's, you know, part of the reason of stepping back a little, maybe when he was younger, is was triggering some anxiety for you, and you weren't quite sure what to do with that, right? And so we kind of give some distance. But the other thing that's heartbreaking for your son is that, again, when neurotic responses, they can start to compound on each other, like not being able to drive or get into large rooms. You know, maybe we can survive if we have one or two. I always like to sit on the aisle in a theater myself. I don't like to be in the middle. But if it started to become, now I have to sit on the aisle in the back of the room, and I won't, you know, you can start to compound these things that it gets more and more difficult to dig out from under. The good news is behaviors like this, neurotic responses to stress, generalized stress, can be unlearned. And the magic of talk therapy is really successful with unlearning these behaviors by becoming desensitized to some of these triggers. And I know there are medications that are available. I don't know, though, that the problem is they never address the underlying stress. They just bring the symptoms down, but they don't heal what triggered. So if, you know, if there's a support group or some talk therapy that he'd be willing to do, that's where I would start, because no one's ever going to be magically perfect. And frankly, William, none of us want to be perfect because it's so boring. Right? It's those ways that were kind of weird and off that make us so much fun, you know, not to Howard Hughes level of fun of locking ourselves in a room, but the things that are a little different. So we're never going to want to flatten ourselves to a place where we don't have any responses, but there has to be a level of comfort where we can live our life in a certain way that's workable.
Yes.
So what would be for you a place that your son could get that you would feel like, I'm okay with this? What level of functioning?
He has been getting some counseling, and he's hungry for it, thankfully. I would say that it was 3 or 4 years ago, it was really bad between him and I. I mean, just terrible. And he would just call randomly and leave messages on my phone that are unbelievably difficult to hear. And then after about a year, he got some counseling. He contacted me, said he wanted to have a healing. He wanted to try to work things out. So the last year has been sensitive, but we've had time together, and we've hung out a bit, and it's been really sweet. And I would love to, you know, I'm just looking for how to go to the next level in that fragile relationship building.
So William, the first thing you have to do is it's time to now forgive yourself for any of the ways you felt you stepped back when he was younger and needing you.
That's so difficult.
I know.
That's so difficult because I feel like I failed him.
I know. I understand the feeling because we feel like we are supposed to be their heroes, right?
And
just be there at every moment. But we are still human. And we're learning and growing as we're raising our children. And it's never, ever too late to step back and say, here's some things I would have liked to have done differently.
Okay. I like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because the more you heal, the more you model that place for him. And that's ultimately what we do for our children as adults. And not just for our own children, but for all of the children we work with and know. You know, we as adults need to do our healing and find our strengths and embrace the parts of ourselves that aren't perfect and own it. And our children then see us owning it and being the best we can be. And it gives them something to work towards.
I hear that. I hear that very much, Doctor. Thank you.
Thank you for calling in, William, and I appreciate you taking the time to share your story with all of us.
Well, you keep up the good work. This work is really necessary. I know you know that, but this work is necessary.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right.
And you're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, give us a call, 805-781-3875. Brian's here to take your calls. We started off kind of talking about neurosis. And again, I want to read the definition because I think there is this idea that any time something's off about us, if we feel anxious or we feel depressed or if we have little OCD tendencies, and again, I'm not talking about the ones that cripple us from functioning, but you know, we all have little weird things. I get pretty obsessive about things that I've said throughout the day. And Brian and I have laughed about this because how ironic, I teach at Cal Poly and I talk on the radio. And at night, I go over everything I've said throughout the day. And then I kind of get into this, oh, I shouldn't have said this in my head tape. And my husband's been sleeping, you know, for a half hour and I'm still rolling the tape in my head of all the weird things I said. So we all have a relative level of neurotic tendencies. And so when we talk about our neuroses, you know, those things that kind of hold us back from feeling like we're at our best, talking about them help us to move forward. Talking about those things that might be considered weird or odd, you know, being a hypochondriac or feeling generalized anxiety or our phobias. One of my very good friends whom I adore is absolutely phobic about whales. Now, she doesn't live in the ocean, but she really doesn't like to drive by the ocean sometimes because of the whale. And she's not going to tell a lot of people, and she's probably going to hate me forever for saying it out loud. But, you know, once we talk about those things that we fear out loud, they don't have the power over us. They don't have the ability to drag us down. You know, some people have very intense eating rituals. Now, you know, wanting to eat things in a certain order in their plate or only wanting to eat certain colors. If we don't talk about that and how it impacts us, we can find ourselves leading into bigger problems with eating disorders or bulimia, you know, anorexia nervosa. So we want to talk about these little neurotic responses we have early on so that we can help to bring down the impact they have on the inside of us. So do you have any special little rituals that you have in your life that you follow on a regular basis?
Oh, you're asking me.
I'm asking you or anyone else. You want to call in at 805-781-3875. The truth will set you free is how I feel. Say it out loud.
I have something that a little bit of a neurosis, I think, that me and my brother both inherited from our father about loading the dishwasher efficiently and properly.
Okay.
And now, during the holidays, when we get together, both me and my brothers, our significant others, get together and talk about how we chastise them for not loading the dishwasher correctly, and we'll unload it and reload it ourselves. And
so what happens to you if you see a misloaded dishwasher?
Well, I get a dirty spoon out when it's done and say, hey, look, this is what happens when you let the spoons spoon each other in the dishwasher. They have to be separate. Otherwise, doesn't do any good.
So do you feel anxious when you see a poorly loaded?
Yeah. And it's been out in the open and we've talked about it as well. Our significant others have talked to us about it a lot. And it doesn't bother me as much. I kind of put my hands up and say, okay.
Because you've recognized it's just part of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not this hidden trait. And mm-hmm. I think that's with a lot of parts of our life, is that saying it out loud and owning it helps to minimize. Now, it doesn't make me like flying anymore, but everyone in my family knows how much I dislike it. So I feel a little less of the pressure. I don't feel like I have to hide it or put on a good face when I get on there. Everyone kind of knows, okay, mom's going to be, you know, not loving life for the next however long we're in the plane. And before, when I wanted to just present myself as strong and immovable force for my kids, you know, I probably showed more because I was trying to put on this really strong face. But I think we have other things in our lives that we do that my kids probably notice about me that I don't recognize, or, you know, that I notice in my daughters, the different way that they want to eat their food or brush their hair or not brush their hair, that they don't recognize in themselves. But also we have superstitions about things that we have to do, like before we compete or before we, you know, go on the air. And how about when you were doing music professionally? Did you have any things you had to do on a regular basis?
There's several things. Just the way I get my equipment all set up has to be in the right order, and just do one thing after the other every time. And sometimes it just doesn't feel like the same instrument, even though there's really nothing different. I just did two things in a different order.
Mm-hmm.
So I have that with music and with surfing. I have the same ritual, how I get ready to go into the water, from everything from when I put my sunscreen on to a lot of stuff. We've got a few callers. I'm going to jump in there and talk to them.
So if you'd like to join the conversation, Brian is answering phones at 805-781-3875. Please be patient. If it rings and rings, just let it keep ringing, because I'm looking forward to hearing your stories, how you feel about your own neurotic tendencies or your phobias. What are some of the things that you hide in your life? What's your greatest fear? You know, what if someone found out about one of your secret behaviors, what would happen? You know, what are you afraid that people will find out about you? Because as I said, the truth sets us free. And I think, you know, we start to arrange our lives in such a way to accommodate the different things that make us anxious or nervous or the neurotic responses we have to things. You know, I think one of my aunts, my mom can probably confirm the story, one of my aunts wouldn't drive over bridges. And so it made it really difficult for her to get to certain places, especially going between New Jersey and Pennsylvania, because everything's got water. So I'm not really sure how she made the trip across the bridge, but she didn't like doing bridges. And so she would, you know, arrange her life in such a way to accommodate that. And I think what we really should be talking about, and part of what we're talking about, is how do we embrace those things about ourselves that aren't perfect? That, you know, the thing that separates us from being robots are emotional responses to things. We respond in our lives on a regular basis to everything that goes on, to the stimulus in our life. And a neurosis, a neurotic response, is considered to be a learned, inappropriate response to stress, that we somehow, you know, over-responded or overreacted to something that happened in our life, and it kind of created this coping mechanism that maybe isn't ideal. But maybe some of those quirky ways that we live our lives are the things that make us lovable, that make us fun, that make us unique. You know, the way that we have to play the music or brush our hair or brush our teeth or how we fall asleep at night. They're the things that make us unique and interesting. So what are yours? How do you cope with it? Julie, you're on the air with The Reluctant Therapist. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, I'm enjoying your program, as I always do, every Tuesday.
Thank you.
And I wanted to kind of address the first gentleman that had called in with regards to feeling that somehow he had failed his son.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as parents, I think oftentimes we all feel that in some way we failed our kids,
mm-hmm.
or that in some way we didn't parent perfectly. And you wish that you could go back and do it different. And like you said, there's still today, there's still tomorrow. And I've had a son that I've, you know, had some issues and been around with, and I've been in counseling and he's been in counseling. And first of all, I guess just to your topic, I think everyone's neurotic in their own way. There's nobody that's not neurotic about something. It's just how you manifest it or the level at which the neuroses comes out. And I also think that the world that we live in today really makes people more neurotic.
Hmm.
I don't think that we live in a culture or a society or a time period on the planet where we're living real stress-free lives. And I think there's a lot of built-in stressors. So one of the things that I find super helpful is my exercise and my meditation time.
Yeah.
And taking the time to quiet my mind and stay calm. And I called into you once before. I'm this person that my motto remains the same, that love is the answer. And I find that the calmer I am with my son and the more that I can just apologize for things I've done wrong and say, if I could do it different, I would, but the past is the past and all we can do now is move forward and I love you and just always love him and just everything I do, I try to run it through the barometer of love. You know, if I have a decision to make, well, what would be the loving response here? You know, that's really helpful to me. And he's calmed way down by my calming way down.
And I think that's a great point, Julie. You know, it was something I was going to talk about, is how we come to people with love. And I think part of that coming to others with love is being able to love all the messiness in our lives, you know, to be able to appreciate all those things that are quirky about our loved ones, our children, our friends, because it's really easy to love people when we're on our best behavior, right? When people are acting lovable, it's very easy to love them. But our real challenge in our life always is to find the love when someone is messy, when their behavior is not ultimately lovable or is something that triggers us. You know, in those darkest, dorkiest moments of our lives, are we able to find those things that we love about those people in our life? And when we're able to love all the messiness in our children and the messiness in our spouse and in our siblings and in our parents, it helps them to feel more lovable themselves. So
well,
I appreciate
it. No, I completely agree with you. And I think a lot of times we're all caught up in thinking that everything's so very complex.
Yes.
And a lot of things are not as complex as they really seem. And I do strongly believe that you know, if everyone can just remain calm and seriously try to come from a position of love and understanding and put themselves in another person's shoes and just calm down, that things are easier to talk about, that people are able to come together and make better decisions, to sit together, look eye to eye, decide, you know, what they want to do, and also accept that it's okay to be a little bit neurotic. I mean, I like to start my day by making sure that my kitchen is clean. I don't know. Somehow it just helps me know that I got that done.
I'm glad you said that, because I was going to ask, okay, Julie, it all sounds so calm and good, but we all have something that drives our day. So
exactly.
I appreciate you sharing.
I think everybody is neurotic.
Yeah, in some way we are. We definitely all bring something interesting to the table. Mary, you're on the air with the Reluctant Therapist. What's on your mind?
Well, wait a second. I'm going to turn my radio off so I can hear you, okay?
Okay. I'm glad you called in. And if you'd like to call in and join the conversation, it's 805-781-3875 to be part of the conversation with a reluctant therapist. And Julie, I hit the button too soon, so I hope if you're there that you know that I cut you off a little early. But Mary, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. I was wondering, I have a situation where a person has a diagnosed anxiety disorder and, you know, has been getting counseling and therapy. Sometimes I feel like she says that she's anxious, and it's not really, it's an excuse for behavior, as opposed to that she's actually experiencing the anxiety. Does that make sense to you?
A little bit. Tell me some more.
Okay, so for example, if she doesn't want to have her son around, she'll say she's getting anxious.
Right.
And then we will take care of the child and don't see her for 8 hours.
Right. I understand. So her coping mechanism has been to kind of fall back on the anxiety as a way of getting out of things that make her uncomfortable or unpleasant.
Well, yeah, I'm sure there's some anxiety with raising a child. Yet, it seems like every day it encroaches upon her. And so sometimes I feel like she just wants to be alone.
I can relate to that. but I think you bring an interesting point that I think, again, it's another topic for another day, but it's one of the struggles I have with the whole idea of diagnosing people. Because once we take on a label of any sort, it starts to become part of how we identify ourselves in the world.
Yeah.
And I think that's the bigger struggle for her, is that now she's starting to behave in the way she's been told who she is. That in some ways she's lost her own authentic responses because someone's told her, here's who you are and here's what the behaviors are going to be. And she's now living out that diagnosis. And that can be very crippling. You know, I understand that there's ways that we need diagnosis for our mental health industry and for people to receive treatment. But I think in a lot of ways it can undo our own ability to care for ourselves and to embrace who we are and to accept those things. Because general, and it's interesting, today before I came into work, I can't remember if it was on the radio or on television, but the end of an ad for a med for generalized anxiety disorder. And I thought, you know, now we've lost it. Because every single response to anything in life can now be attributed to a sense of generalized anxiety disorder, which is generally how we feel when anything makes us a little anxious or stressed. But we're going to now start telling the story about ourselves that any time we feel anxious or stressed, there's something broken or wrong in us. And once we start moving from this place of feeling like we need to be fixed, we've lost our power. And we've lost the ability to accept and embrace who we are and to love who we are and to move forward in our lives. It kind of freezes us in this place. And that's why I wanted to talk about neurosis and neurotic behavior today and more of a kind of a lighter side, and not to minimize people who are really struggling or feeling like they are impaired and can't live their life. But I think if we can embrace some of those strange things, our freakish flag behaviors, and say, here's who I am. Here's some things I like and don't like. You know, as I mentioned, I always have to sit on the aisle at a concert or in a movie theater. And I know it's inconvenient for my family, but you know what? They've come to love me for that strangeness, and we carry on.
Yeah.
So I think I wanted to talk about these things to lighten it a bit, because everything becomes this intensified, you know, idea that, oh my gosh, it's a mental illness, and everyone freezes. But we don't freeze when we get a cold, because we know it's going to pass. You know, we don't freeze when we have the flu, even though it's horrible and painful. We get treated and it will pass.
Right.
And when we look at mental illness, quite often I think we look at it as a sentence, a life sentence. Like, now I have this and it is who I am for life. And that cripples us.
Yeah.
I don't know if I answered your question at all, but I definitely went on a tangent.
I will get off the line and find out how to reach you and see if she will make an appointment with you.
I'll be happy to refer out, but you can always find me through my Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or emails to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And I appreciate you taking the time to call in, Mary.
Thanks.
Enjoy your day. And this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We're kind of all over the place today with different topics, you know, and along the lines of neurosis and neurotic tendencies. And I always think of that song from Guys and Dolls. Now I'm not going to be able to, either I have to sing it, which will be horrifying, and my daughter will fall over in her chair listening to it. But she talks about the neurotic tendencies, that we can get physical manifestations of illness as a response to things that aren't going well psychologically. You know, maybe if you really fear competition, or you get very stressed before competition, you can get crippling headaches that can make it more difficult to compete, and it kind of begets itself, where you are feeling nervous about competing, and then you start to get a headache, then you think, now I really can't compete. And so we can have these, you know, visceral symptoms that come up when we go through stressful situations. But I think, to me, there's a couple keys to today. You know, one is this idea of embracing those funky parts of ourselves, and learning to embrace and notice those things in the people we love, and to love them for it. You know, when I see my younger one putting her hair up in a hair ribbon or a hair tie a lot, you know, I know she's feeling a little nervous. She's a performer. She is on stage all the time, and I can see her little ritual things that she does to get ready to perform, because it makes her nervous. Does it mean there's something wrong with her? No. She has a healthy response to the pressure of getting on stage, and she's kind of come up with these coping mechanisms to calm herself before she goes on stage, and I see it more as healthy. When my older daughter was younger, she had trouble, you know, getting to sleep at night, and I felt like somehow I, as the mom, had failed, because I didn't want my children to ever feel nervous or anxious or uncomfortable. But the older they've gotten, the older I've become, the more I've been able to just embrace kind of how messy and fun life can be, the easier it is to just look at them from a distance and not feel personally responsible for all of their responses, but to be able to just embrace and love them for the messiness, and to help them learn to embrace and love themselves. And, you know, Julie brought the whole idea of love up. That's what we're here to do. You know, human beings live for love. It is what we're wired for. And a lot of times we start to hide our neurotic responses, or our anxious responses, or our depressive feelings, or our weird little rituals, because we're afraid it will make us unlovable. And so we hide those behaviors and responses. But what happens is they start to get a hold of us and get deeper and darker. Jennifer, you're on the air with The Reluctant Therapist. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, I'm just in relationship to the conversation and kind of talking about looking at, you know, people's neuroses or their issues, and trying not to have always such a heaviness about it, or you know, treating yourself or other people like they're a pathology.
Yes.
Versus a person. And I get that. But it's really difficult when it is in your family. I think it's much easier almost to be objective, and even maybe more kind and more patient with people who are not in your family, because, like or not, we do have expectations, higher, I think, expectations of each other when we have familial relationships, particularly with our parents. Mm. And I bring that up because my dad has a really bad OCD. Mm-hmm. He's had it our whole lives. I remember as a kid it being, you know, strange and embarrassing, and, you know, never named. He's never gotten treatment for it. So as he's gotten older, particularly in the last, you know, 5 to 6 years, it's getting a lot worse as he becomes an older person. Mm-hmm. And it's complicated, because you do have, I think, as a child of a parent, no matter how old your parents are and no matter how old you are, you're still their child, and you have wrapped up in that relationship those feelings of you were supposed to protect me, you were supposed to be my example, you were supposed to be the person that made me feel safe and helped me form my ideas of the world. Mm-hmm. And so it's complicated to be loving and forgiving and patient of a parent when you feel like they have brought something into your life that's frightening. And now I find myself having, you know, issues, mm-hmm. my own self. And I'm like, it sounds awful to say it out loud, but I'll say it out loud, which is I have a little bit of, like, resentment, like, wow, you gave this to me.
Mm-hmm. Like somehow you know? He passed
like,
it on.
Yeah, like you passed this on to me because on some level, like, you didn't have the courage mm-hmm. to deal with this mm-hmm. yourself, and I was exposed to it all the time, and now I don't know whether it's genetic or a learned behavior or, you know, a psycho-spiritual karma, whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's complicated to just see your parents as people with their own struggles and their own issues, just as human beings. It's really hard to do that because there's a part of you that can never separate that feeling of, yeah, but you are supposed to be my parent.
Right.
You know?
Right. You said that so beautifully, Jennifer. Just beautifully. And I think, you know, it's funny because I look at my parents and I'm older than you, I'm sure, and they're older than me. And I had it took me a long time, even being a therapist for 20 years, to see my parents in any sort of diagnosable state, you know, to be able to look at them, because they were still my parents. And so they always say you can't do, you know, surgery on yourself if you're a doctor. You really can't do therapy on yourself if you're a therapist, because you can't separate.
Right.
And so I really understand that feeling of, you know, kind of looking towards my parents as still, you know, leading the way. But I think one of the powerful things you said is that you say it's complicated, and yet there's still a lot of love behind what you're saying, that almost like if you would get help, we would all get help. Mm-hmm. And maybe the gift you're going to give your family is that you're going to address these things and model that success and heal your father in some way. Mm-hmm. And he may never address the OCD pieces, but it will give him some peace knowing that you're okay.
Well, it is an interesting thing to see my parents, both of them being very concerned with my own issues.
Right.
Some post-traumatic stress, some issues from as a result of a car accident. But also, when I look at it, it's more like that issue, mm-hmm. that event that mm-hmm. has caused what other people might perceive as, oh, you've been having a lot of difficulty this last year since that accident. All that stuff was going on before the accident.
Right. It just triggered it.
Like the trigger that kind of like blew the door off.
Yes.
But it's really interesting to me that that I can get some compassion from my parents around it, and yet they won't look at their own stuff. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of go, it's such a strange thing to be able to look at yourself and go, wow, I'm recognizing some of these own behaviors in myself and those things that I really, like, I can almost use the word despise, mm-hmm. like really recoil from, really frustrate me. Like, I just, you know, it's like, how did I become that? The last thing in the world that I said I would never act like that. I would never be that way. And there it is in my face. Mm-hmm. And there's something strange about the karma of it, in the sense that it makes me feel much more compassion mm-hmm. for people who are going through this, because I'm like, wow, that could be me too.
Yeah, but it's opened your heart and your spirit, it sounds like.
Yeah, but it's also this really interesting thing of how to watch them feel compassion for me, but not be able to address stuff that's just so clear and so obvious.
Their blind spot is obvious. And I think that that's going to be, you know, when we see our parents with feet of clay and all those great cliches, that it's parts of our soul achingly having to grow up. It's the peeling away of our childhood expectations. And that's painful for everyone to go through. You know, it's those last layers of your childhood fantasy that there's going to be someone, and that's painful, and we feel resentful. It's like, why weren't you that superhero? But it's that peeling away of your own layer, and as you heal and move forward and do your own growing, again, you heal your parents in a kind of metaphorical way, and you become your own parent, and that's going to ultimately be the strength that you have.
Well, thank you for that, and thank you for letting me, you know, put in a few cents there to the conversation.
I love it, and you know what? You've set yourself free because you've said it out loud.
Thank you.
Enjoy your day, Jennifer.
Bye.
And you are listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. It's a big day today, Brian. I thought it was going to be just kind of lighthearted, but I think that, you know, we do all feel these things deeply, that we want to be seen as perfect and lovable and whole, and then those parts of us that aren't feeling perfect and lovable and whole can make us feel a little ashamed or held back or resentful. So, you know, we do struggle. We struggle as a community. We struggle as individuals. And we are going to have time for a couple more calls at 805-781-3875. I know people tend to wait till the last second, but we'd love to hear from you and hear your story. Talk about those things in your life that you might be trying to fix, or that you're embarrassed about, or what is that thing, you know, that if anyone knew, they probably wouldn't love you. Those are the things that make us messy and lovable and warm. We'll be back to take your calls, A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist.
That number again to call in and speak with Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist, is 781-3875. It's area code 805-781-3875. There is about 8 minutes left in the show. We have time for one or two more callers. Here's a highlight from the KCBX community calendar. The comedy thriller Audience with Murder opens this weekend at the Pewter Plough Playhouse in Cambria, with a preview on Friday and a champagne opening on Saturday. The play runs through the month of June. For all the details, go to the community calendar at kcbx.org. Brought to us by California Strawberry Farmers. The number again to call in is 781-3875. We have time for about one or two more calls.
You know, it's funny. The other side of the coin for this conversation, and I think that's all things in life, right? There's the dark and the light, the yin and the yang. That I talk a lot about those little quirks and personality traits are the things that we tend to fall in love with our significant others about, you know, those things that they do that we just find adorable. But they can also become the thing that drive us insane. You know, those things that started off as being, oh, that's such a cute little quirk about my husband, or I love when my, you know, girls do this. My younger one tends to be kind of a blurter. She'll say inappropriate things out loud in public places, and we'll all turn around and think, oh, gosh, I hope no one heard that. But that's part of her quirky personality, and I love it about her. But at the wrong times, I'll think, oh, please, no, don't say that out loud. So there is those parts of our life that are never, you're never at a place where you hit the sweet spot and it's perfect forever, right? You get into a relationship, you love this person, you embrace those things about them that are quirky and odd. And, you know, I talk to my young couples that are getting married, that you're really marrying the stranger things about your partner, because it's easy to love them when they're great and normal. But it's the stranger things about our partner that we have to fall in love with, because that's the thing that's going to be around quite often. But it also can be the thing that can cause a lot of problems in relationships. So we have to work to understand what our own neuroses are, our own kind of neurotic tendencies, our understand those things about us that might be quirky or different, so that we can appreciate when our spouse is struggling with our behaviors, or that we can own it. And when it becomes a behavior that prevents us from really enjoying major parts of our lives, like if we have, you know, uncontrollable anxiety attacks or OCD that prevents us from functioning, having a job, living our life, or some sexual dysfunctions that can really hinder, you know, the pleasure in your relationships, phobias that prevent you from going places, you know, those things can be unlearned. Those things can be treated through psychotherapy, talk therapy. They don't have to be medicated. They can be worked through. Medication can help through the rough part, but to not hide out forever. And if they're more light neurotic things, you know, then you can find them to be just part of who you are, and to embrace your wiring, embrace who you are and accept it and not fight it, because it's the fighting our nature that gets us into trouble. Hey, Zed, you're on the air with the Reluctant Therapist. What's on your mind?
Hi. I was just listening to your show and listening to what I think her name was Jennifer, mm-hmm. sharing mm-hmm. about her struggle with her parents. And
yes.
I just wanted to mention that I've gone through a similar thing with my parents and made some inroads with that. And part of that was, you know, discovering the challenges that my parents had to face, you know, and specifically my father. He was in World War II. He was in World War II, and I found out recently that he was part of the crews that cleaned up the death camps after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, as you can imagine, back then, they not only didn't have a treatment for PTSD, but they didn't even diagnose it.
Nor recognize it.
Right. And so, you know, I believe that PTSD is passed on through generations, especially a case as severe as that.
Mm-hmm.
And for many years, I was had a lot of anger and resentment toward my father.
I'm sorry, I hear the emotion in your voice, and I wanted to support that because what you're saying is so important, and I hope Jennifer's still listening, is that understanding our parents' journey and how they got to where they are and how this OCD or whatever the coping mechanism they found, you know, how that came to be a way they had to cope from something in their life can help us to build that compassion for them and can heal us. I mean, understanding your father, it sounds like really healed you in many ways.
Yeah, that's true. Because, you know, today I kind of function from a perspective of I believe everybody's doing the best they can.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we don't know what other people have gone through, and we may know a little bit, but truly we don't know the inner depths of what another being has gone through, you know.
No.
And we each cope as best as we can based on, you know, our experiences and our challenges.
Right. And how we've been taught to cope and how
right.
we've learned to respond to stress. And yes, absolutely.
And so, you know, today, you know, my father is no longer with us, but, you know, my feelings about him are much different, much better. And I have a deep love for him. And, you know, I picked up some of that PTSD, and now I have a 21-year-old son who has some resentments toward me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's only been in the last 5 years that I've really started to make changes in my own life. And so, you know, I try to be an encouragement to him to help him, you know, in his journey to get past, you know, the feelings that he has harbored about me, just as I have done with my father. And it's a challenging road because he's not at a point today where he's willing to give any of that up. But
right.
I keep interacting with him in love and, you know, trying to display the, you know, I don't know, what's the word, the grace that I have experienced, not to attach any connotations to it, but just, you know, yeah.
To the compassion. And, you know, our kids have to get to an age where they're old enough to be able to hear our story and see us as separate beings. And as long as you keep coming to him with honesty and compassion, he'll get to a point where he's able to hear the story and you'll continue the healing. And Zed, I appreciate you calling in today and sharing your story with me.
All right.
Have a great day. And this has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I appreciate everyone taking the time to call, being part of our community. We can continue this conversation on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or through an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Brian, thank you so much for answering all the phone calls.
My pleasure.
Hope you have a great week.
Me too.
And I appreciate everyone supporting Public Radio, our caring talk for the Central Coast. I look forward to talking to you next week.